You're listening to the Isoca Podcast. I'm your host, Abby Norton, and today I'm speaking with Cindy Baxter, author of the IS Audit and Practice column in the Isoca Journal. We're going to be talking about Cindy's Isoca Journal Volume 2, 2021 article, Relinquishing Privacy to Research. Thanks for joining me today, Cindy.
Abby, thank you for having me.
Absolutely. So to get us started, in your article, you state, with no internet in 1948, privacy must have felt different. No social media, no information network, no big data either, just paper records. Can you elaborate on the idea that privacy has changed in the digital age?
I think the medical community, of any community that has gone through transformation because of technology, has been one of the most impactful on really all of us. Because medical technology touches everybody, that transformation has made a huge difference in terms of how privacy is handled. When I did some initial research to what I knew to be anecdotal information about that Framingham Heart study that I referenced that started in 1948, it really emphasized the privacy that existed really between a patient and a doctor, really within four walls, plaster walls, wallboard walls, but certainly not anything that was technologically oriented back in that day. Truly, a doctor would go back into another room, pull a paper file, and the records and the information kept within were between that doctor and that doctor's staff. As we think about the concept of research back in the late 40s and the 50s, it really was a much more manual environment, and in essence, a more controlled environment because it depended upon very specific individuals looking at information and sharing information. Just like today, there was the concept of granting rights by the patient. Certainly, the doctors made decisions in terms of how to take that access and apply it to what they were trying to do, whether it was simply for the health of the patient or for a general research endeavor, similar to what the Framingham study did back then and continues to do today. So that privileged patient-doctor information has evolved to be much more than a restricted set of private documents between a patient and a family for treatment or a hospital and a doctor's office for study. Instead, it's really into a vast network that's truly ubiquitous. It joins a dispersed number of records, and patients have the opportunity to, in fact, give and grant that access rights to people they don't even know by simply clicking. So it creates a whole new complexity and certainly a whole new set of ethics when we think about privacy and the impact from where they really did this kind of a study back in the late 40s.
Absolutely. Your article briefly touches on how storytelling and communicating have evolved. How have medical supplies, medical information, and medicine itself become a part of this public dialogue?
So storytelling is always interesting because we live in such a social media age. And I think what's, of course, interesting is in this day and age, with everything that people are going through, medicine is always the breaking news, whether you're on watching TV, whether you're on Twitter. Everything starts with medicine today. Even the ads that we watch are no longer delivered through the doctor-patient relationship, but medical companies or drug companies, pharma companies are coming directly to the patient to encourage patients to have that reverse dialogue, if you will, about their illnesses and how certain drugs might improve their condition. So certainly ubiquitous medical information is a gift, but it's a gift that has to be guarded. We all know a lot more and we all benefit a lot more. Research staff has always lined up for samples, whether they're lining up in the, you know, outside the operating room, hoping to catch something that they can then use for research. Well, what we're looking at now, where instead of that tangible sample, if you will, that new data that's everywhere allows them to model conditions, use algorithms in a way that they've never been used before. All of us, the research program that I highlighted, provide structured data within a common platform. And that allows researchers from a variety of institutions to come up with statistical information, with results that are easier to corroborate. And of course, that benefits all of us because it facilitates not just the collaboration, but it facilitates the results. So when you think of stories like the Framingham study and how that has evolved, it's a vast difference in terms of how they might look at heart health care today. When a hospital, say, where I live in Massachusetts, looks to the research data that's available to them and how they might treat a coronary patient, because there's always more than one option when you're looking at how to solve somebody's disease, whether it's a drug therapy, whether it's a surgical therapy, or even if it's an endoscopic procedure. There's never only one answer. Frequently, one answer is not always rising to the surface. So how do they get there? They really get there because of the shared communications or stories that the data allows us to have. It also makes for much more robust communications. So where it used to be much like a monologue from a doctor to a patient, with a patient taking a slip of paper and filling a prescription or going in for a procedure, now the information is more of a dialogue. The doctor will frequently stand by the patient's bedside, not with a pen and paper, but with a laptop or some other device, pull up information based on a patient's question. And there may be a number of questions, not just because the patient doesn't understand something, but because the patient is being asked to be part of the final decision. And again, all of that is brought about by research that is really doable because so much more data is available. And that data is available to allow the interaction and collaboration that just wasn't possible before.
So along those same lines of having so much access to information, how can an IS auditor provide structure during what you refer to in your article as the proliferation of information sharing and marketing?
Well, Abby, this is kind of a great question right after your last question, because to follow up to my thought on storytelling and how that promotes better outcomes in the healthcare industry, is also a warning about what is privacy. Is privacy really private when you choose as the patient or the research volunteer, when you choose to openly and ubiquitously share that information? And the answer is, if you've released that information, you've really given access. Certainly all of us as a research program go through great lengths to make sure that people have their privacy protected. That said, as I highlighted in my article, I couldn't really remember 6 months after the fact what I actually did to relinquish my privacy. I just basically did. It seemed like the right thing to do. And it still absolutely is. But when I did that research, both that are present for researchers and controls that are present for those volunteers like me who are sharing their information, whether it's for the greater good or because they might find out something interesting about themselves based on the shared data, that relinquishing of privacy becomes all the more protected because an auditor or a risk assurance professional is looking and examining the criteria for divulging that information. I think the role that an IS auditor really provides is the structure that allows us to take health information, which is much sought after worldwide, and ensure, first of all, that there's accuracy. When we tell stories, everybody embellishes, or everybody hears what they think they were told, but if we're not well, or if we're anxious to contribute to a certain result, the reality might change. An IS auditor examining criteria, understanding where the data is coming from, and of course, having a structure embedded in the privacy laws and GDPR as that is applicable, help give that overarching protection that volunteers may forget that they've relinquished. So I think that that accuracy level in terms of how the data is used and the structure as it applies to privacy laws are really important. I think research enthusiasm is also fueled, depending on the country of where you live, by that competitive angle. Universal healthcare systems like Canada are a very collaborative system where data is shared. And absolutely that is shared within, there's a lot of data shared within the states. And the All of Us Research Program is an excellent example of that. But as we've seen through the pandemic, pharma companies, others who are involved in the industry, whether it's medical devices, even, you know, consumables like, you know, say that you're eating a margarine that is not going to promote high cholesterol. That's a very competitive market. How the data is used, how the clinical trials are executed are really important in terms of, again, accuracy, but appropriate controls to make sure that the privacy of that very personal information that validates a clinical trial to be valid, accurate, and usable data to release a pharmaceutical or a device, those controls and that protection of privacy becomes absolutely paramount. And of course, making sure that the information is private also guarantees the objectivity. Once again, auditors play a key role in that to make sure that the structure, the framework, and the regulations are adhered to.
In your article, you pose the question, with such a complex structure involving so many people with so many backgrounds, how can an IS auditor create the most meaningful audit result? How would you answer that question?
I think auditing gets down to the basic framework. I feel strongly that the benefit of being an auditor is that you truly are objective. The downfall of an auditor is you're never going to know as much as the people you're auditing. It's just not possible. So in a trade-off for objectivity, the way that an auditor really can manage through complexity is by doing the basics in terms of having an interview or talking through the details of the proposed scope of work with the group that's going to be audited. Of course, having that foundational information in privacy regulation so that there's something to really understand in terms of comparing to what the scope of work might be. It's really critical to do that essential walkthrough, not just talking and interviewing the person who might be the head of the research firm or the head of the smaller project that perhaps is just using one small piece of data that the All of Us program might be involved in, but actually watching what people do from step to step to step, conducting that walkthrough to examine where does privacy come into play? Where is it protected? What is a manual exercise as opposed to a machine-triggered exercise? And setting up that scope of work so that truly you break things into sub-pieces and tackle those manual elements by working with those who perform the work, and then ensuring that you're doing proper tests of one for automated systems so that you know that the repeatable outcome that a platform will produce is in fact an accurate platform and that the assumptions built into the code match an objective outcome that will lead to research that is meaningful and not skewed in any fashion. I also feel that it's important to validate what you're finding as you go through that process. So once you've chosen the scope, once you've walked through the actual process so that you've got a good feel as to whether there might be gaps with some of the privacy laws that you're looking at, it's important to go and stop when there are questions immediately as possible. Ask the individuals who are part of the process if you've understood what you're seeing accurately, if you are, to move forward, if you're not, to get the necessary correction. If, as you move forward, you find that there might be a gap or an issue, instead of waiting until the entire audit is completed, it's important to identify that issue to the people who are being audited, really for two reasons. First, of course, to validate that the issue you think you found is an accurate one. If you go on for the rest of the audit, you might make an assumption based on your first finding that you're understanding a certain path when in fact maybe you're not. So you want to validate and ensure that you're on course with the way the audit is proceeding. The second and equally, if not more important factor is if there is a gap or an issue, it's something, especially in healthcare, that may need immediate resolution. Identifying that item to those who are performing the research or doing a medical procedure or creating a product for medical use may make a huge difference in terms of the efficacy, not only of the product itself, but in terms of patient health as well. So I think those basic practices for doing a walkthrough, identifying the scope clearly, discovering what questions you might have and airing those questions as soon as you have them, confirming any issues or gaps so that you know you're on track, and then allowing the team to provide feedback or to take action based on the immediacy of the need is what makes a research strong, objective, and reliable.
This episode of the ISACA podcast is brought to you by ESET. ESET has been on the forefront of cybersecurity for over 30 years, helping businesses and people in more than 200 countries enjoy safer technology. The experts at ESET know that even with the latest cybersecurity technology, without proper training, your staff could be the biggest threat to your organization's security. You can reduce your risk of successful cyber attacks by training your employees on a regular basis. ESET makes cybersecurity training easy. Here are the top four things ESET says you should know to become a cybersecurity MVP. Number one, with password security questions, fake answers offer real security. Number two, phishing scams only work if you're not paying attention. Number three, two-factor authentication is the number one way to keep sensitive accounts safe. Number four, public Wi-Fi is just that, public. For more expert advice and cybersecurity training tips, check out ESET online at business.eset.com/ISACA. Right now, you can get access to free training at business.eset.com/ISACA. Kind of related to the idea of asking questions and getting feedback, your article discusses why auditors and auditees should document the scope of the audit and get full concurrence by all stakeholders. Can you talk more about the importance of communication between the audit team and the team being audited?
I think one of the most dramatic changes in medical technology today has been the communication factor. As I alluded to really a little bit in your first question, Abby, the conversation was often a one-way conversation. When I think of my grandparents and conversations they might have had with their doctors. And things really don't proceed that way anymore. There is a different culture in the medical community, and auditors should take advantage of that. Whether you're auditing a research firm, whether you're auditing a hospital, no matter what the medical aspect is, the culture of collaboration has increased dramatically and in line with social media. So just as everybody shares really things that I would never have imagined being shared at this point in time, but there you go. You can see people's health records on the screen as much as you can see the last vacation they took or the pizza they made last night and what the special ingredients are. So understanding and having a thorough conversation with those who will be audited will lead in what I think is the most important outcome, and that is to make sure that the scope you choose is actually going to benefit those who are going to be audited. All of us as auditors have a basic premise of needing to meet regulatory requirements, no matter where we are in the world. That said, what we all dream of is our doctors, our medical staff, our researchers being able to continuously improve the work they're doing to our benefit. Certainly, we want them to have efficiencies and feel like they're doing something rewarding and they're getting somewhere and it's not rework all the time. But it's a very selfish need to say, I want to make sure I can live forever. And forever never happens, but you can get close. At least if the people who are being audited have a hand in defining the scope and knowing it's something that's actionable. A very broad scope in a complex environment can often mean missed expectations. All of us can only act on a certain number of items. And for that reason, the auditor plays an all-important role, even as the scope discussion ensues, in terms of understanding where the risks are and how to prioritize the audit work. That can't be done in a vacuum. So the conversation promotes open communication, and it does identify an easier method for issue discovery. The conversation also means that complexity becomes a less burdensome activity, and that allows the scope to be more appropriate to the work that can be performed and actioned, and it also facilitates concurrence because everybody starts with a realistic expectation. Then finally, with concurrence as an expectation, it really promotes a better understanding from the get-go on what privacy is all about. The auditor examining the privacy considerations in the healthcare industry can consider herself or himself the expert. Of course, the medical community, like all of us, pays attention to stringent privacy rules. But as auditors, we know the complexity of the privacy requirements. We know how to structure things, and as we have that conversation about privacy at the onset of establishing the scope and the expectations that lead to concurrence, it creates a much better awareness with the group that's being audited so that they can, of course, self-police after we leave and complete our work.
In your article, you state familiarity with the way things work at the local organization level is a must. Time spent with those who do the work is the best reality check. What are some of the risks that come with not getting to know the enterprise before performing the audit?
Certainly, based on what I said, having that common understanding with the group that you audit is paramount. And of course, when you're auditing a group, you're not auditing the world. You're really auditing what they do. Familiarity at the local level is a must, and it's really a good reality check because, yes, privacy laws are consistent. We all have very basic tenets in terms of guarding privacy, allowing access, restricting or discontinuing access. GDPR, of course, focuses the privacy efforts that step further on the rights of individuals, and all of that has to be considered. But how those privacy regulations are met is going to vary based on the processes developed and deployed at the local level. By using one set of processes that might be different than either another country or another hospital or another research organization might develop processes, doesn't mean that the privacy requirements are not met. Understanding how the process is used and why it's used in a certain fashion locally means not only are you speaking the same language as those you're auditing, which means it's much easier to have concurrence and to get actionable improvements made, but most importantly, it's a matter of having an effective audit. Ultimately, if a small local hospital is using a legacy system to manage their patient records, it doesn't mean that their older system is not addressing the privacy requirements. Understanding how they use it, perhaps in a hybrid fashion, where record keeping might be somewhat manual, but primarily automated, is critical. It's also critical to recognize that tools and technology, although it might vary, is not just simply what facilitates and enables the work, but it's also what is the intended outcome. So privacy is applicable based on a process that uses private data, and there may be a variety of outcomes that are expected. And understanding what the local outcomes are is important so that you as an auditor have a good idea on what data is being used, why the data is being used, what the expected outcome is, and whether that's appropriate. Not only can you examine appropriateness, but as we come into a much more automated world, you can determine whether it's necessary, either as part of the scope or as a subsequent scope, to look at algorithms that might be used, AI that might be used, or a number of different models that may be used by the community that you're auditing to ensure objectivity and to ensure that the privacy of those offering the data is kept as it should be, fully private.
Do you have any final thoughts about your article that you'd like to share with our listeners?
I appreciate the opportunity to give my pitch, just as I know I did a little bit in the article. I think that the evolution in medical technology is amazing. One of the employers I was fortunate to have was definitely in the healthcare industry, and complexity is everywhere. But the evolution has been amazing. I can think back to the time when my sister-in-law was just graduating and doing clinical work as a cardiac nurse. And amazing for now, it was not uncommon for her and her colleagues to call a doctor in the middle of the night because they couldn't read the paper record on the end of the patient's bed to figure out, is it 100 milligrams of this medication or is it 10 milligrams of this medication? And that's life and death. Now we don't even face that kind of a world. Because of data sharing, because of people's acceptance of electronic records, because of what I mentioned in an earlier question, where literally you can go into your own medical records and click a button that allows your doctors and the medical staff to look at tests or visits that you may have had at other medical institutions, it means that all of us are safer and that information is available when we give permission so that solutions can be found a lot faster. So for that reason, it was really a pleasure to do the research and understand what the All of Us program was all about. I not only feel good about it, but I truly believe that programs like the Framingham Study and the All of Us program, which is part of the National Institute for Health of the United States government, really those programs are bringing us to not just accelerated outcomes that save lives, just like we've experienced in the pandemic, but they're accelerated, accurate, high-quality outcomes that could not have even been imagined because there's so much data available from truly dispersed and diverse sources. And I think that is a gift that none of us can ignore and all of us benefit from.
Well, that about wraps up all the questions I had. Cindy, thank you again so much for coming back on the podcast.
Thank you, Abby. It was a pleasure to meet with you, and thank you for asking me back.
That's all the time we have on this episode of the podcast, but to make sure you never miss an episode, be sure to subscribe on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts.